This is the first of three beta lectures that Lenka Zdborova is giving for us. And I'm supposed to introduce you a little bit to Hans Bethe, who is a colleague of ours until amazingly recently, and who has lots of interesting stories about it. In my second introduction, I'll be more formal, but right now I just thought I'd give you some anecdotes. This is showing him with his slide rule. He used his slide rule all the time he was around. Towards the end, I'm told by Peter LePage that he was trying to understand why his colleagues at Los Alamos Livermore and their supercomputer simulations were failing to get their supernovas to explode. And he had a printout and he was paging through it and checking it with the slide rule and guided them to the right answer. Hans had an amazing impact on science. You'll hear a little bit more about one little aspect of his huge contributions. He was one of the early practitioners of quantum mechanics, and he had amazing nuclear physics was his specialty, but he had big impact on astrophysics, condensed matter physics, quantum electrodynamics. He had an amazing impact on the world, both in leading the Manhattan Project's work on the nuclear bomb and in weapons control and treaties. One of his mantras was always work on problems for which you have an unfair advantage. His unfair advantage, of course, was not just that he was very smart, but also that he was early in developing techniques in quantum mechanics and other problems. He had a good sense of humor. I'm told he there was somebody, Eddington, I think, or somebody who was trying to derive the fine structure constant in ways that he thought were amusing. So he derived it by doing numerology, starting from the number of absolute zero in Celsius. That was supposed to be funny. Anyway. And then there's a famous paper by Alfer and Gamov, which was on Big Bang nucleosynthesis, which Gamov insisted on adding Bethe in absentia as an author because he liked Alpha, Beta, Gamma. And Bethe got a copy of it and crossed out in absentia and decided he'd be happy to be an author on this paper. So with that, I have an introduction to Lenka Zdrib. I practiced it. it's Zdebrova. Deborah with a Z and an A, Zdebrova. She's a leading figure in a new powerful branch of statistical physics. That is, it is new compared to, for me, but most of you weren't born when it started, but it is undoubtedly powerful. It's our basic tool for modeling disordered and glassy systems, for predicting and explaining the behavior of systems in high-dimensional networks like the brain, and like the deep neural networks underlying ChatGPT, and for developing fast algorithms for solving the hardest problems in computer science. She has won several prizes for her accomplishments. I'll quote the citation for only one, the Philip Meyer Prize of 2016, for having succeeded in extending the frontiers of statistical physics by formulating a unified approach to questions such as disordered systems, inferences from noisy data, the structure of algorithmically difficult problems, and the possibility of reconstructing multidimensional signals from low-dimensional measurements, compressed sensing. Since 2016, when she won that prize, other topics really have to be added to the list, In particular, her elucidation of the properties and fundamental limits to the performance of deep neural networks, like ChatGPT, in solving hard inference problems. Zdeborova leads the Statistical Physics of Computation Laboratory in École Polytechnique Fédérale de Lausanne, normally known as EPFL, in Switzerland, where she is a professor both in physics and computer science. She will be giving this lecture, the beta public lecture on Wednesday evening at 7:30 here, and a computer science lecture Friday noontime that will be Zoomed in Clark 700. Finally, graduates and postdocs are welcome to meet with her after this seminar in PSB 403.
Thank you. Let me switch the slides. Thank you so much. It's my first time in Cornell, and I'm impressed by everything so far. Thank you so much for the invitation to this lecture honoring Hans Bethe. So given that, I couldn't do other thing than to call my lecture something like From Bethe Lattice to Unraveling Complex Systems. So let me walk you through what I mean here. This was supposed to be working. It is working. So as Jim said, I will really be talking about like one little paper among all those amazing accomplishments of Hans Bethe, this one called Statistical Theory of Superlattices, that he wrote, in my understanding, just a bit before coming here to Cornell, when he was in the UK after having to escape from Germany, working kind of under the umbrella of Bragg, who also, as you can read in the paper, suggested this problem to him that kind of makes sense. Bragg studied lattices. And if Wikipedia is right, Bragg was actually the one visiting Cornell when Cornell was looking for a new theoretical physics professor and recommended Bethe to Cornell. So that's how then, a few years later, he actually came. And what's also interesting in this paper is that he says the section 5, which is the core of the paper, is actually entirely due to Pyles. So that's also why this paper is often referred as a better Pyles paper. So what he did there, already back then, there was the Ising model and the idea of explaining magnetism with it. And the fact that on a lattice that is, you know, going to infinity but is a square lattice, Ising model could have an interesting behavior, but that's very difficult to solve analytically. And there was only the Curie-Weiss approximation that many of you probably worked out during your physics studies, that is assuming that every atom interacts with every other one, that is does not sound very realistic. So what Bethe did, but this is hard to solve. Curie-Weiss is unrealistic. So what he did, if I actually, instead of this lattice, took a lattice like that, where the middle atom is the same one, these four neighbors are the same ones, and then these second kind of neighbors, the dark green ones, are these ones, and you see that in a sense, each of these gets copied here, in a sense, twice, and then they are not connected to each other. And it's this structure that conditioning at the center, the branches are not connected to each other, that allows us to compute analytically the partition function, the free energy, and all these things in statistical physics that we need to actually understand what's going on in the problem. So the way this is done, this is a slide that could be from, say, undergraduate statistical physics towards the end of the class, where we could, next to the Curie-Weiss, and we actually do that when I taught that class, next to the Curie-Weiss solution, make the exercise of actually walking through the Bethe solution to the Ising model, where you have the Boltzmann measure for the Ising model on a given graph, given by the edges here. And the Bethe solution writes this equation that, you know, there is the arcus tangent hyperbolic and the combination of why exactly this tangents kind of you need to work through, say, 10 lines. But it's easy. What we are aiming at is to compute the magnetization at the center And if we have a fixed point to this equation, we actually have the magnetization at the center. So it's of a similar difficulty as the Kurzweil solution to the Isaac model. But this one is in many ways better. So it's still mean field in the sense that the exponents that we often care about in statistical physics are the same one. But when you look at its prediction for the critical temperature itself and you compare the beta value to the one of actual 2D or 3D lattice, you see that in two dimensions, which correspond to the coordination 4 here, it's not far away. And in three dimensions, it really gets close. So even the critical temperature, the Curie, the prediction for the Curie temperature, which is a non-universal value, is actually really well approximated by this approximation. And now if I go to the title of this lecture, which is From Beta Approximation to Unraveling Complex Systems, what makes this kind of simple approximation of the lattice and this one simple equation actually this powerful tool that solves a lot of interesting current problems on complex systems? So I kind of thinking about it, three steps that are crucial on that way, and I will walk you through them in the first part of the talk. And this one textbook, for instance, that for me is an example of what unraveling complex systems means today, where the word beta appears 140 times. So you see there's some influence. There's the beta free energy, the beta approximation, the beta lattice, like different. So the first step, what one needs to add to beta's paper to get to unraveling complex systems. One needs to first realize that this, what he did, works not only in these ordered homogeneous magnets, but also in disordered systems. And this is something that David Towles put very explicitly in a paper in 86. And this is, so he used, Towles in his paper has exactly that same equation. Now you will see this slide maybe 6 more times in the talk. And the only thing that he did, he actually took this interaction here, not the same for every pair of spin, but randomly plus or minus 1 over square root of n. Sorry, there is a square root missing here. And so when you do that, actually in this equation, the Gij appears here, and the local magnetization is still given this way. And now this actually does not have a ferromagnetic phase transition anymore. This actually has a spin glass transition. And I will also show you in few lines how actually Towles derived this phase transition, because you will see this slide again in a context that is aimed to surprise you. So again, the same equation. How do we analyze where there is a critical point? We usually realize that there is a fixed point that is simple, like the paramagnetic here, where these U's are 0, tangent of 0 is 0, or cotangent of 0 is 0, it's a fixed point. Then we linearize around this fixed point. We do an expansion when these U's are small. This is how this equation linearized looks like. Then if we take averages, we get 0 is equal to 0. So this is not helping because Gij's are random. But if we now look at the variances, so averages of the squares, we actually get this equation. And we realize that if the temperature is bigger than what's given by this equation, then we are at the paramagnet. And if it is smaller, then something else is happening. And that's indeed the beta prediction or Towles prediction for the critical temperature in a spin glass. The second step, about the same time, is in this paper by Marc Mézar and Giorgio Parisi. We will see them back in a moment. What they realized is actually that, so on the beta lattice, if you kind of think about it, there is a bit of a trouble with the boundary condition. What do you do with the boundary condition? The boundary on a tree is as big as the volume. That's kind of not nice in physics. We would like the boundary to be eventually smaller than the volume. Otherwise, we lose things like nucleation. And so what would be nicer if we actually could work on a system like the Erdős-Rényi graphs that did not exist back when Beta wrote the paper, but that did exist when this paper came out, where you actually, in the connections between the nodes, take every connection with some small probability constant over n, the number of nodes, and do not take it with 1 minus that probability. Or random deregular graphs, where you also do it in a way that everybody has exactly, in this graph, I think it's 6 neighbors. And so what Mezar and Parisi did, they realized that since these graphs created this way locally look like trees, that the beta approximation actually applies and provides exact solutions for these graphs as well, not only on the beta lattice. And on the ferromagnetic Ising model, this is true, just as I said it, that the beta approximation is the exact solution on a lattice that looks like this. But to prove it rigorously, it took till 2010 to actually work out the epsilons and deltas of that. So this is non-trivial. This is non-trivial. And the nice thing here is many real-world systems are represented as graph networks in computer science, data science, biology, many things. So this really changed things. These are not only bizarre infinite trees, but random graphs. And the third step is that people stopped thinking as physicists and started thinking as computer scientists. They asked about algorithms. How is this related to algorithms? And the influential paper in there, or the one that realized it, is by Kabashima and Saad, where they did the following thing. They took again the same equation. This talk is really only about this equation, I think. And now the time indices here, they are actually the iteration times of an algorithm that is sending messages, so these U's then become messages, that the nodes of the graph are sending to each other. And this is done with the random initialization as long as it stopped when it reached convergence. So you really now start thinking about it not as an analysis tool, but as an algorithm. Now in the problem of, oops, this is too much, sorry. In the problem that we are talking about in the spin glass on a random graph, all beta lattice, this actually converges to 0 above the spin glass temperature and does not converge below the spin glass temperature. So if it does not converge, then it's not very useful. So how is this useful? Okay. But, and this is, this paper was 99. But this realization that it is related to the algorithm and that we should start thinking about it as an algorithm, that led to a paper that changed everything. In which sense it changed everything? So this paper, analytic and algorithmic solution to random satisfiability problem. The satisfiability problem is this key problem in computer science that teaches us which problems are computationally hard and which problems are computationally easy. And the random instances, that's actually something that was realized by Bart Selman, who is your colleague here in computer science department, they are particularly interesting to actually test challenging, they're challenging to test algorithms. And what they did, they took the same, not exactly the same recursion equation, but almost the same one, and called it survey propagation, and could solve algorithmically instances of this KSAT problem that nobody else could solve before, and that blew minds of some people in some computer science departments. And it also blew minds of some master student, at least one, in Prague back then in 2002 or 3. And I was totally mesmerized by this paper, up to the point that I bugged Marc Mezar with many, many, many emails and visits to Paris, until he agreed that I can actually do the PhD with him. And that's where, so I guess when Jim said that you should work on problems on which you have unfair advantage, I guess that's my unfair advantage, because this paper, what it changed was the interaction between the physics community being aware of these techniques and being interested in these problems, and colleagues in computer science, information theory, statistics, mathematics, and other areas where actually problems that can be solved with these methods arise. And the communication with, the kind of relation and communication between different people from different disciplines, that in my understanding of the field changed with this paper. So many people got interested, and that's an unfair advantage of a PhD student to start their PhD thesis. So that's what I did, not alone, with the help of Florent Chakala, with whom since 20 years we are working on this field. We co-authored about 110 papers, which is about 2/3 of the papers I wrote, and we co-teach this lecture for doctoral students in EPFL, which is online, with all these techniques. So if you want to learn it in detail, you can go to that webpage. There are also some byproducts of the collaboration that kind of arise. So coming kind of to the type of problems that we work with, I want to show it off on an example from, say, statistics or machine learning. It's a prototypical example of unsupervised learning is clustering of data or clustering of networks. Appears in many applications, in many forms. You have a graph, networks, and nodes. Some pairs are connected by an edge, some are not, and there are groups of nodes that kind of play a similar role, but you don't know who is in which group together. You want to identify that from the structure of the network. So now, you know, if you got lost because you did not even know what the Ising model is, which may be true for some of the undergrads in the audience, come back, because in a sense, I will explain to you now what the Ising model is. But on an example, because when I think of a, you know, practical problem, I first need to distill it down to a model, like the Ising model, to something simple where I can do math, where I can understand every single detail of what's happening. So here is my model for clustering, and I will introduce it on a very kind of, a simple example of playing a game with my audience. So I imagine I have a deck of cards. Each card has either +1 or -1 written on it. And the game starts that I deal, there are roughly the same number of each in the deck. I deal at random, everybody gets one card. And then was the game. I choose pairs among you, and I ask you the following thing. I give you a, say, four. Sorry, this is randomly changing. This will not work if it's going. Where is my four-sided dice? I give you a four-sided dice, here it is, and ask you to tell me whether you have the same card. But I will ask you, and you will go by the rules, if you roll a four, you lie. So even if you don't have the same cards, you tell yes, and vice versa. And if you roll 1, 2, or 3, you actually tell the truth. Okay? And you don't cheat. You kind of tell the truth and lie when you're, you know, according to your what was on the dice. But I don't see the dice. I don't see what was on the dice. All I get is the answers, yes or no. So then I collect, you know, many pairs, certain number that will be a parameter, and get the yes or no's. In yellow here, I have those that lie, that actually have had 4 on the dice. But I don't see, now I can forget about the people. And I don't see who had which card, and I also erase the yellow. I don't know who lied and who did not lie. This is what I see. This is the data that I see, and my task is to guess who had which card, or actually you will realize there is an up-down symmetry, so split the room into two groups so that the groups within have the same card. That's my problem here, okay? So it's a prototypical model for clustering. I want to find back these two clusters based on observations of +1s or -1s that sit on this Erdős-Verny random graph. And the way I do it, so how do we formalize this in terms of probabilities? So I denote the cards +/-1, you will see the spins, and the answers I will denote them with jij, and then by the rules of the game, I know that the probability of j given the neighbors is actually given like so, with this row being given. This is the probability of the dice, and I will now write it. If I reparameterize the row in terms of beta, I can write this equation in this form. You can persuade yourself this is true by just checking. Because of this +/-1 here, this is true. And now if you remember your basic Bayesian probability, what I want is the probability of what were the cards given what I observe. So I use the Bayes rule, plug in the expression from previous slide, And what I get for the probability distribution here is the Boltzmann distribution of the Ising model. So if you did not know what's the Ising model, now you know, because I just defined the Ising model for you. So now there's the okay distribution where the rho, the probability on the dice, is related to the temperature, inverse temperature. And inference of the cards boils down to actually computing the local magnetizations in physics terms. So that's exactly what Beta does for us, right? You remember. The only difference with the previous model here is that the GIJs are not random. They are created from this kind of planted configuration that are the values of the cards I actually gave you. This we did not have before.
What is the dependence on the 1/4?
The dependence on the 1/4 is in the beta, because rho is 1/4. And instead of rho, I'm using beta. Right, this is one-to-one mapping between rho and beta. Thank you. So then, OK, you saw this slide already 3 times. So 4th time. Now I have the Boltzmann distribution of the Ising model. I write the same recursion. This gives me the local magnetizations. And what this planting does for me is magic. There is not this trouble with the non-convergence of the belief propagation algorithm that in the disordered system jargon is called replica symmetry breaking. So no replica symmetry breaking in this card game that we are playing together. So I can use the algorithm, this recursion as it is, as an algorithm, to optimally solve the problem. Optimally in the limit of a very large audience. But I don't need 10 to the 23 people in the audience. The size of this audience is good enough that I will, you know, the difference from optimality will be invisible for already a few hundred nodes. So here is a graph of how actually my ability to split the room into 2 groups where in 1 group people have mostly the same card, how it depends on the number of pairs I picked. So the more pairs I picked, the more information I got, the easier it should be. And naively, you would expect that, you know, maybe if the graph is not even connected, something will be happening. But here, 2 questions per person. Sorry, 2 questions per person. That's actually that everybody gets asked on average 4 questions. Right? There are 2 persons by 1 question. So that's already pretty connected graph. And there is this phase transition, second order phase transition. If I don't ask at least 2 questions per person, then I can get absolutely no correlation with the ground truth values of the cards. And this is irrespectively of which algorithm I'm actually using. And this can be proven. And if I have more than 2, then I get a positive correlation, and then it grows up to 1 when the number of questions over n goes to infinity. And in the physics terms, where is my? In the physics term, there is a slide missing. Okay, sorry, there were some. Yeah, in the physics terms, this is just the paramagnetic to ferromagnetic phase transition, just like in the ferromagnetic Ising model. This planted clustering problem, this planted spin glass, just behaves as the ferromagnet. So this is nice. And now, you know, what does something like that actually bring us? So one nice story is that this understanding of what's going on and how to optimally achieve it actually inspires new algorithms. So let me give you one. So when we talk about clustering, these algorithms, Bethe piles / belief propagation, the abbreviation is the same, so BP, are not the ones that you usually think about if you are in like applied data science department and you want to do clustering, right? If you want to do clustering, you usually think something like that, principal component analysis, right? This is a beautiful example that I use in my classes to explain what PCA can do for you. Just from the genetic information of mutations in different people in Europe, you can actually do PCA. And the first 2 components, if you rotate them well, they recover the map of Europe. It's just beautiful. So spectral analysis of data. Also for our card problem, You can think of spectrally analyzing, looking at the spectrum and eigenvectors of this matrix of plus and minus ones that I collected. And that's spectral clustering of graphs. You compute the, if you have Q clusters, you compute the Q largest eigenvalues of that matrix, and then embed everything into the lower dimensional Q dimensional space, where then you can run something like K-means that works only if the dimension is not too big, but now you brought it to Q dimensions, so it's good. And then the matrix that you use, you know, in the literature, there are like 100 of them maybe, but the main ones would be either directly the adjacency symmetrics, or the Laplacian, or a random walk on the graph, or the modularity matrix, or you know any other variant that is your favorite one, and it gives you, when the graph is dense, great results. Now the problem here is that our graph is sparse. There are only, say, 4 or 6 questions that everybody answered, so the number of connections is fixed and the number of people goes to infinity. And when it, and you know, this is our game because I defined it like this, but it seems artificial. But in practice, clustering of sparse networks is relevant because the number of friends you have on Facebook probably does not grow with the size of Facebook. It's rather, you know, fixed by the time you actually have to spend with them, etc. In similarity-based clustering, it might actually be costly to get those similarities. It might like cost you that you actually persuade some users to click somewhere. So this may not be so easy in recommender systems. The ranks, for instance, users ranking movies on Netflix is also a very sparse matrix. And in big data, the matrix may be even so large that you cannot even store it. So you actually want to sparsify it to be even able to run your algorithm if really it's really huge. So it's important that these methods actually work on very sparse graphs. And they don't. So all these methods that I showed do not work on sparse graphs, because instead of the leading eigenvectors picking the information that is there, which is the, you know, one group having plus one, another group having minus one, they are picking some other things about the graphs, such as dinging trees or high degree nodes. And you know, each of these four methods that I cited picks something a little bit different. But the spectrum of a sparse graph does not have this nice structure of a semicircle from which an outlier gives me the structure. It actually has, you know, in Condé's matter theory, we could call it Lifshitz tails of eigenvalues that are there, that are localized, and that are not telling me anything interesting about the global structure of the network. So in sparse graphs, the traditional clustering, spectral clustering methods do not work. And our goal was to fix it. And in this paper 10 years ago, we suggested another matrix based on the adjacency matrix. It's very simple to compute. We called it the non-backtracking matrix. You just need to take the adjacency matrix and construct now a matrix that is not n times n, but it's actually, if you have m edges, number of edges, it's number of edges twice times number of edges twice. So it's a bit bigger. And it's constructed this way. And now when you actually do spectral clustering in the sparse case with this matrix, there's the blue points, and you compare to the optimal belief propagation, there's the black line, and then you compare to these traditional spectral methods that I told you, you know, do something, but only when the signal to noise ratio is really much larger than what it needs to be. So this gap, in a sense, we are closing with this non-backtracking matrix. Now you are, okay, that's very nice, but how is it connected to what you told me so far? So that's where you have, for a sixth time, why the non-backtracking matrix, this slide, right? Because if you paid attention, and I'm sure some of the sharp undergraduate students see it, the non-backtracking matrix is there. You saw it already. You just need to think about it a bit unconventionally and forget about the fact that you're actually wanting to compute the critical temperature and kind of stop this calculation in the middle and look at this linearization of the Bethe piles recursion. When you linearized it, what you did here that's a power iteration of exactly the non-backtracking matrix with some factor in front of it that is a bit different for the clustering. But morally, this recursion here that you are going, you know, the message node I is sending to J depends on the neighbors of I that are not J, the other neighbors. That's exactly this recursion that defines the non-backtracking matrix. And because this Bethe-Pyles recursion has the right critical temperature, the right threshold, and this is just the linearization of it, then the power iteration, you know, gives you the leading or the second leading, depending on eigenvalue. If you kind of normalize it right, the leading eigenvalue actually of this gives you exactly the same formula as the formula that Tauler's derived for the critical temperature. So this argument proves that, okay, this is just the same thing, showed, you know, this critical value that we have seen before is at the same time a phase transition in the spectral property of this non-backtracking matrix that is telling you whether this eigenvalue that carries the information about the cluster is out of the bulk or inside the bulk. And, you know, walking here, I have seen all those posters on the walls advertising the lecture. This weird kind of Sauron eye that you saw on that poster, that's an artist's view of this spectral density of the non-backtracking matrix. So now you know what it is. So here is a performance on our spin glass game. Again, the overlap is slightly smaller because it doesn't kind of threshold the information as well as the belief propagation does. It kind of gains a bit from the fact that it's nonlinear, but this spectral method has the same threshold. So exactly the same threshold. And it has some other advantages to this Bethe-Pyles / belief propagation algorithm. It doesn't need to know any parameters of the model. The belief propagation needed to know the right temperature, if you notice that. And it's not restricted to these tree-like graphs, and it's trivial to implement. You just need to know PCA, and you understand how to do that. And it's great in learning the number of clusters. That's another parameter that for the Bethe-Pyles algorithm I actually needed. And for this, it's just the number of eigenvalue out of the bulk gives me the number of clusters. So this is great. It works on some real-world benchmarks of clustering of networks. Here are some examples and their spectra. And the message here, kind of the paradigm to kind of connect Bethe-Pyles and that kind of line of work in statistical physics to designing new algorithms is this one. You just take the statistical physics calculations from last century and you stop them before doing the average over the disorder. And you interpret it algorithmically, and that's your advantage. At least, you know, for me, it kind of worked for a number of papers. So the last part of the talk, I want to kind of show you what are we doing with these kind of methods today. And so far, I only talked about thermodynamic equilibrium or kind of inference problem that can be represented as a posterior probability distribution / Boltzmann measure / again, thermodynamic equilibrium. But can we also understand the dynamics of these systems and properties that are far from equilibrium? So what I mean concretely, I distill it to one concrete question that, again, I kind of was aware already during my PhD, had no idea how to attack it back then, which is the zero temperature dynamics of the Ising model. So all those of you who kind of know what's the Ising model know about Monte Carlo can simulate the equilibrium of the Ising model. And if we put that Monte Carlo at zero temperature, then what it boils down is that at every time step, we flip every spin. Now it's axis, before it were S's, but it's the spins. We flip it in the direction of the magnetic field. The magnetic field is just the sum of our Jijs, times the values of the X. Or we keep it as it is if this field happens to be zero. Okay, so this is an example of a more generic kind of dynamical rule where we have discrete time, where we have this time variable, that we have these variables that depend on positions in the network I and depend on time t, and dynamical rule that is a pretty arbitrary function of what I am at time t, what all my neighbors are at time t. And this guides, this function can be generic, this guides what I become the next time step. And for what I will be telling you to work, I need this to be synchronous and deterministic in the sense that we usually, in physics, when we simulate the Ising model, it's usually at finite temperature, which adds some randomness to this process. So I keep it at zero temperature. There is no randomness here. There is randomness in the graph, but there is no random variable that actually influences the dynamics. It's deterministic and synchronous, meaning everybody is updated at every time step. Okay, so it's a very, very simple dynamical process on a random graph involving, say, Ising spins. And even the simplest questions were open about this. So for instance, where does this go? Does it even go to a fixed point? Or does it go to some attractor that actually is not a fixed point? And if it goes to a fixed point, what energy is this fixed point? At what, you know, value of the Hamiltonian? So these are difficult questions. That back in my PhD, I would be that's awesome to answer something like that, but had no idea how to do that. And so let me kind of explain what we are asking here. So the dynamics is as defined. And here I have a little example of the graph on which we actually want to be, for instance, looking. So here I have 12 nodes. It's a three regular. Everybody has three neighbors. Okay. And then what is plotted here is actually the space of configurations of all 2D. So if I have 12 neighbors here, 12 nodes here, here I have 2 to the 12 possible configurations of these nodes. Okay. And those are all the points. So they are orange, red, and blue points. All the points are all the 2 to the 12 configurations. And what are the connections between them? Well, that's when this configuration in the next time step becomes that configuration. So the connections are the steps of the dynamics. If I start here, I walk to the center. The dynamics walks into the center. If I start here, I walk here. And then the blue clusters are those that actually the initial conditions from which you go to a fixed point. And the orange ones are initial conditions from which you go actually to a cycle of length 2. So that's already, I didn't know that you actually often go to cycle of length 2. But then I learned that one can indeed prove that in the system, you can only go to either attractor or cycle of length 2. But cycles of larger length are not possible. So that's a like simple 10 line proof. And then there are also works that, for instance, count the number of fixed points and number of cycles of length 2. So for instance, this one. And now the main idea kind of to show you the generality of this belief propagation approach is that we can do the following. We can count the number of configurations that are at most p step away from an attractor. So now our spins won't be just variables plus minus 1 anymore. The whole trajectory of p steps will be our spin. But our spins can be vectorial. That's not a problem. We still can apply this Bethe-Biles approach. So we will do this here. And now I have just 3 slides to kind of show you a bit of a generic form of these equations that, OK, will be overwhelming if you have never seen it before. But if you watch the 14 weeks of the doctoral lecture, then you will find them clear, at least the students that passed the exam. That's kind of what. So I assume that you would pass the exam. So these are our spin variables. As I said, they are not just scalar. They have now size p plus c. So p and c will be some constants, not going to infinity while the size is going to infinity. C is the length of the attractor, and p is the number of steps I take to get to the attractor. So these are my variables. I can forget now that they are actually p plus c dimensional. They are still spins, vectorial spins. And what I need to write a probability distribution that takes into account all the constraints that the dynamics is giving me. So there are really only 2. One is that the component that corresponds to time t, if I apply the dynamics to it, is indeed the component that corresponds to the next time step. But this is all kind of there because the variable has all the times. And then this one that actually says that the one at time p plus 1 is the same one as the time as the one at time p plus c, because that's what defines the cycle of length c. Okay, so I apply this dynamics. So this needs to be true. And this is a probability distribution. Okay, I can also add to it observables such as the energy, the magnetization. I do it the usual way. I add the value of that observable with some chemical-like potential here. And then if I am able to compute the normalization here, that's actually the free energy. And then number of configurations for which this quantity is fixed, I get it by doing the Lagrange transform of this free energy. So that's the usual kind of statistical physics, the first class of statistical physics, how entropy is related to energy. There's just a special case of this. Okay, so this is something like well known. And now all I need to do is that probability distribution, I need to write it as a product over edges and nodes of a graph that locally looks like a tree, like the beta lattice, so that this approximation is actually right. So now for my case here, where the dynamics depends on the value of all my neighbors, if you actually kind of naively draw the interaction graph, you actually have many loops around, because I'm connected to my neighbors are connected to all their neighbors, and you see that this is creating a lot of short loops. This doesn't look like a tree at all. But there is a well-known trick how to fix that. What you need to do, you take your variables and you copy them on the adjacent edges, which creates a new factor graph, graphical model, that's, you know, terms from the lecture, or you know them, with variables sitting on the edges and the original nodes playing the role of the interactions. And you create this graph of variables and interactions that looks kind of what this is. But we have a very generic form of the belief propagation, whatever the functions corresponding to these factors and the magnetic fields corresponding to the variables, and whatever the variables are, as long as their size is of order one, we can actually write the belief propagation for them. And this is how it looks like in a form that doesn't even look so complicated, because kind of the complexity is hidden in what these little a and big A actually are, because that's collecting all the constraints. And at the end of the day, it's not, you know, okay, if you want to understand the details, go to the lecture. At the end of the day, what do we get? So what are the results for this zero temperature synchronous quench that, you know, to me was maybe academic problem, but I didn't know how to say anything about it till last year. So what I'm showing you here is a result for four regular random graphs, so everybody has four neighbors. P is the length of the trajectory that I'm considering. And the first column is actually how many of the initial conditions lead to a fixed point or to a length to attractor in this many steps. So here actually to a fixed point in this in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 4 steps. And it's written in which units, log 2, that's the entropy of everybody, because I have 2 to the n possible initial conditions. So the entropy divided by log q is like which fraction of the entropy I'm covering. Okay? And you see that at the beginning, not much. This is just how many fixed points I have. But in 7 steps, I am at 1 up to the 4th digits. Now, this is entropy 1. So even this is a 4th digit, since everything is exponentially large, still almost everybody is not accounted for. But in physics, it would be very strange to get the entropy converging to every, all the entropy, yet something else actually being the actual physics. Right? So this is a very reasonable conjecture that this is actually converging where the random initialization would be leading us. And if we compute then the energy of that initialization, we get these values. And if we simulate actually where this zero temperature quench goes, we see that in 7 steps, we are at, you know, the 3 digits are right. And the 4th one, maybe, we would need to go a bit more steps. And if we actually applied this dynamical cavity method, where the variables are the trajectories, forward, not backward, we would actually also get rather close to this energy. So I also didn't know that you need to go just 7 steps, because this is like glasses systems. In glasses, you always need to do the dynamics for a long time for anything to happen. So the fact that here it happens in 7 steps, when I saw these, when the student brought me these numbers, she was, of course, not divided by the log 2 because we didn't know, right? And I saw the numbers, I said, my God, this is going to the log 2, right? You recognize the log 2. So this was a surprise. And so what this tells us is that we finally know analytically where the zero temperature quench goes in the Bethe lattice spin glass, in the anti-ferromagnet on a random graph, or also in the ferromagnet and zero magnetization. Because all these three are actually equivalent to each other once you put them on the random graph. So that's kind of a by-result of this method. And now you may be asking, this is a very brutal dynamics. This will not go somewhere interesting. This will be stuck somewhere at high temperature. That's actually not the case. That's also surprising here. That's kind of illustrated in this table. Here is the equilibrium. That's the lowest energy you can go to. That's the ground state computed by Parisi. And this is where this replica symmetry breaking happens, where you know the, in the spin glass, this like Bethe approximation needs to have some complications added so that it works. Okay, so this is a system where at this energy something very complicated happens to the equilibrium, and this is the lowest energy you can possibly get. And now look where the quench is going. Okay, so for degree 4, it's going somewhere above where something complicated happens. So that's what you would expect. But for degree larger than 6, it actually goes below where the replica symmetry breaking happens. So this tells you something very funky about the landscape. It tells you that if you look at the slice at a given energy, you want to count everybody equally, then the structure of this probability measure is very complicated. Yet if you ask where this greedy, super fast and simple dynamics goes, it actually leads you below. So physically, to me, this is surprising, that it leads you like well below the RSB energy. Now, you will also maybe notice that this is only for, I'm showing you all the even degrees. Why didn't I show you odd degrees? There is actually a reason. Because it doesn't converge to a fixed point, but to a 2-cycle for odd degrees. So OK, that's, you know, 2-cycle energy is not interesting. But something else is interesting is happening. I will more describe it in words in just 1 minute. I did not know that in the Ising ferromagnet, so the, you know, the model we started with, slide 1, when you actually run this dynamics from random initialization, you go to a cycle. But obviously, if your initial magnetization is close to 1, say everybody is 1, this is just everybody flips in the direction in which majority of their neighbors are. So if almost everybody is 1 at the beginning, everybody will very fast be 1. So it's clear that if you start at magnetization close to 1, you go to consensus. If you start at 0, you don't go to consensus. So where do you need to start so that you go to consensus? There is a critical point, a dynamical one, not one that can be derived from equilibrium, of initial magnetization, starting from which you actually go to consensus. So the existence of this point was predicted by previous works, and some bounds were computed. By the location of this point was actually not known. And this backtracking dynamical cavity method gives us, again, the location up to easily 3-4 digits, depending how much time you want to spend solving this equation. So just a few steps backwards actually allow you to very accurately locate this dynamical phase transition. So to me, this is something nice. I didn't, you know, I did not think, even like, you know, before we did this work, that I can say something non-trivial and new for the ferromagnetic Ising model on a random graph. You know, this seems like something, like everything has been done. Like, okay, not quite. So I will conclude with, you know, the Bethe approximation. I hope I persuaded you that, you know, kind of the twist that allows you to exactly solve and provide optimal algorithms for problems as a broad range of applications. These are just a few examples in all those fields. And some recent progress, including the analysis of the synchronous deterministic dynamics via the backtracking version of the dynamical cavity method. And thank you for your attention.